Hello again and welcome to I've Got a Beatles podcast. This is Dave coming to you solo today, and we're going to do something a little bit different out of our usual format here. I'm very excited to welcome Aaron Kadovich to the show. Aaron's the author of a recent book called The Beatles and the Avant-Garde, and if you remember way back to our Christmas gift episode or holiday gift episode, it was actually one of the books that we recommended in our book segment, and I first came across Aaron's work at the International Beatles Conference in Altoona, Pennsylvania, and so it's very exciting to have him here for an interview. So I want to welcome you to the program, Aaron.
Thank you very much for having me.
And it turns out we actually have some mutual people in common that we know, and that's where I want to start here, because your own background, I think, plays a big role into how you decided to write this book. You have a musical background, and so
yes.
If you could tell us a little bit about your own background and what struck you, particularly to write a book about the avant-garde, and if you could explain to our listeners, how do you define avant-garde?
Yes. Yeah, that's a question I get a lot, actually, about this book. But my musical background and education began at Butler University in Indianapolis. And I got a bachelor's degree in music theory and composition from Butler in 2008. I then moved to Boston. I did a master's at Boston University, graduated 2010, and then matriculated at the University of Hartford in Connecticut. And while I was a grad student at the University of Hartford, I won a research grant through the university to really study the Beatles in depth. And ultimately, that's a big way of how I was able to write this book. And the way the grant worked was the university gave the university library money to make purchases at my request. So I was able to buy all sorts of books, CDs, DVDs, even some old VHS tapes. And I've spent the last, 3 or 4 years wading through all of the stuff that I was able to buy using this grant money.
Wow, lucky so, you.
Yes, yeah. So it's definitely an ongoing project, but that's kind of how I came to it. I came to it from an academic context, but at the same time, I try hard not to be overly technical with my vocabulary. I try not to use too many buzzwords and jargon that that would isolate non-academic audiences. Now, at the same time, avant-garde art is very popular in academic contexts. And I define avant-garde for the purposes of this book as anything that is very deliberately and consciously pushing limits and pushing boundaries and trying to be innovative and break with traditional art and what other people are doing. The Beatles managed to do that while maintaining a high degree of accessibility. You don't need you don't need to know how the music works in order to appreciate it. But when you start looking behind the scenes at the more academic side of it, it really does give you a much more profound appreciation for the artistry of the band. So that's a little bit about my background and where I'm coming from in writing this book.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty interesting, because I think you maybe in the book, or I've seen it elsewhere, you mentioned the Beatles are, of course, are very mainstream now and most successful group in history. And did they view themselves that way? I know John Lennon had a very disparaging comment about the avant-garde, even though he certainly had affinities for it. What are kind of the main ways that you view the group themselves as avant-garde?
The whole book is essentially structured around a shift in who was the avant-garde Beatle. And Lennon is famous for his association with Yoko Ono as being the avant-garde Beatle. But of course, Paul was actually the original Beatles avant-gardist. And so when at the time, in the early years of the Beatles, into the mid-60s, when Lennon was less fond of of avant-garde art. Paul was the one who was really exploring all this stuff, and he actually met Luciano Berio, who's an Italian avant-garde composer, and he was very fond of Karlheinz Stockhausen, a German avant-garde composer. John Cage is an American avant-garde composer, and so Paul was very much aware of all of them and appreciated their contributions not only for the intellectual, the ideas behind them, but also as music itself. He appreciated them as music itself. And so what he does with a lot of his own things is incorporate these avant-garde influences into what he was working on. So in the case, for example, Tomorrow Never Knows is a good one, because he uses tape loops, which is something that he learned from people like Cage and Stockhausen. The orchestral sound mass in A Day in the Life is probably the most famous such example. And so he's bringing all of these avant-garde influences into a popular music context. And at some point I say in the book how John and Paul were both popular musicians who gleaned what they could from the avant-garde, as opposed to someone like Yoko Ono, who had a strong background before she ever knew John Lennon. She was well established as an avant-garde artist. So both John and Paul bring this kind of outside influence into Beatles music, into a popular music context. And then over the course of the band's existence, you see a shift from what used to be Paul's aesthetic experimentation to what ultimately ended as John's experimentation along with Yoko.
That's interesting. So that dispels the common myth of John as always the most avant-garde artistic, always experimenting, and Paul's just a showman who wants to get a hit here.
The granny music that we talked about. Yeah,
exactly.
And there's reasons why they've earned those, that kind of stereotype, but at the same time, it's not entirely true.
I found it particularly interesting reading the stuff about Paul, because I knew, I know about the Stockhausen connection, because that's often written about. But I love the story about Paul smoking pot, listening to Berio and Cage. And I just imagining this is really a crazy kind of scene here. So I wonder how much, I mentioned pot. How much do you think drug use, or the fact that most of the stuff happened in the Revolver, Pepper, 66, 67 type days here, how much do you think drugs impacted the sense of maybe looking for something beyond what they're normally doing, or would this have happened anyway? Or
I don't think it's coincidence that their more experimental aesthetic song, aesthetically experimental songs, came at the same time as their greatest experimentation with drug use as well. But nonetheless, Paul had an interview, I think it was with Q magazine, in which he talked about how it's easy to overestimate the impact of drug use on the Beatles music. And so what I usually say is, this is a very common question that I get quite frequently, is think of how many people have experimented with the same drugs that the Beatles did and haven't been able to produce, the music that they have. So true. No doubt their drug use is influencing their aesthetic principles and tendencies. But at the same time, if there was not musical talent there to begin with, no amount of drug use could compensate for that. Mm-hmm. So they are first and foremost musicians. Their drug use perhaps helped them think outside the box. But at the same time, to quote Paul again, it's easy to overestimate that influence.
Yeah, that's a very good point that I think is worth reminding ourselves. The music does come first. That's very true. And speaking of, my own research or my own work is on the American composer Charles Ives, who certainly is seen as very experimental and not mainstream.
Not at all. No.
Yeah, to say the least. You make a good point that I often think about with Ives, is that sometimes the music, the end product or the end result, is not necessarily very successful, but you learn a lot from the journey. And I think Ives learned a lot from some of his experimental works that maybe pretty rough listening now, but you know, it helped him solve some other problems and other pieces. So can you give an example of a something in the Beatles catalog that, you know, their avant-garde tendencies just maybe didn't work necessarily, but it was important to them?
The first thing that comes to my mind is Lennon and Ono's first avant-garde album, Two Virgins, which essentially was them. They got together at Lennon's mansion at, what was it, May 68, and they just started recording, you know, whatever came to mind. There wasn't a whole lot of preconceptions or pre-thought out notions of what they were going to do. So they just, you know, whatever came to mind, they recorded it. And the album is essentially that. And on one hand, it's a profound notion to think that anything you can do can be art. You know, it's very easy, especially with classical music. You think of, you know, there's this reverence towards music that, you know, the composer slaving away, this genius composer slaving away. And I mean, there's something to that. No doubt, you know, there is something to that. But at the same time, it's equally profound to think that anything and everything can be art. And that's really what John Cage is all about in trying to open up musical avenues and you know, so at one point he played an amplified cactus in a piece. Cage did.
Yep.
And you know, it's like, why not? Why can't this be art? It's very profound for John Lennon to say, look, we don't have to spend a whole lot of time on it for it to be art. We can just make it up off the top of our heads and see what happens. At the same time, however, when you don't invest a whole lot of time into your product, the product may not necessarily be musically satisfying. And I, without being too subjective here, Two Virgins, I think, is not the most interesting thing that John and Yoko ever produced. But at the same time, it did open up avenues so that further down the road, they were able to explore more perhaps successful experimental avenues. So that's what comes to mind when you talk about finding new roads, even if that initial idea isn't terribly successful, it leads to things that are successful down the road.
And hold that thought about Two Virgins and the John and Yoko collaborations, because I have some more stuff about that coming up here, because I'm sure if our listeners have heard any of the first three experimental albums, I think they would be very interested to hear your thoughts. So we'll get to that in a little bit here. Now, you talk about the holy grail of unreleased Beatle tracks, which would be the Carnival of Light, which,
yes, indeed.
I looked online afterwards to see if I could find it anywhere, and no. And the funniest is on YouTube. You type it in, and people are like, "This is it," and then all the comments are like, "Fake, fake, fake."
Yeah, they're totally.
Can you? Because very few people, if anybody, has really heard it outside of maybe Mark Lewisohn and you know the people there at Abbey Road, but. What is Carnival of Light? Why is it infamous? What's so interesting? And do you think it would be worth hearing?
Carnival of Light is the pinnacle of Paul's interest in the avant-garde. And after that, they recorded that January 67. And shortly after that is when Lennon really starts to discover his interest in the avant-garde. And so it kind of concludes Paul's time as the avant-garde Beatle. And it is a quite long, essentially an abstract sound collage. And much like Two Virgins, all four Beatles were in the studio and they just collaborated. And you know, whatever came to mind, they put it in the track. So there are recordings. I have never heard Carnival of Light. I'm just basing, I'm basing everything I know on it on you know, books that other people who have written, like Mark Lewisohn, who has actually heard it, mm-hmm. and Paul McCartney's recollections in Barry Miles' book many years from now. So it consists of things like, you know, John Lennon shouting out Barcelona, and there are chimes and things that that they use. So I think Barry Miles actually calls it an exercise in layering. Oh. So they recorded all these things, and then they just layer them on top of one another. And it doesn't necessarily have a narrative structure to it. It's not really trying to tell a story, but rather it's this kind of abstract collage of sounds. So it on one hand, it really represents Paul's pinnacle peak of avant-garde interest. And then on top of that, the fact that it hasn't been released really creates a large demand for it.
Oh, yeah.
If this had been released on the anthology, there would be much less demand for it now because you could just go on the anthology and listen to it. But the fact that it's like a secret thing, a Beatles track that we've not heard before, gives it this like iconic status, even though it's not a terribly accessible piece, and I suspect when it finally is released, eventually it will be, but it might be years or decades, who knows, I suspect there will be a little bit of anticlimactic feeling when we actually hear this thing that we've talked about and heard about for so long, and we finally hear it. I suspect many people will be kind of disappointed because it's not what you expect from the Beatles. At the same time, that's the whole point of it, is they're really trying to do new things and get outside themselves. And that's what Sgt. Pepper is all about. You know, it's not the Beatles recording this album. It's Sgt. Pepper and his Lonely Hearts Club Band recording. It's all, a way of getting out of all the patterns and behavioral patterns that they were so sick of with their fans at the time. So they record this in January 67, which is the same time that they were recording Pepper. So it's all about doing something different. And that's I think ultimately the point of it, and I think that's why they did it. It's just a way to break the routine and do something new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'll be very interested if it ever comes out.
Yes.
Your description is very good. It makes me want to hear it. So yeah. I hope.
Well, that's helpful. Yeah.
Yeah, I hope someday it'll come out. It's kind of a general thing here about avant-garde. We tend, at least in the academic community, you think of it as more. It's always related or associated with things that are dissonant or you know, for people who aren't musical, noisy or ugly,
yes,
types
random
of sounds. Yeah, random, all this kind of stuff. I think of in some of the Beatles songs, little bits that are like that mm-hmm. like, for example, the end of Strawberry Fields. It kind of has a bit of chaos to it with the drums going.
Yeah,
And all of that. Can avant-garde be sort of a small little feature, or is it something more in conception, or how do you view it in terms of the Beatles' output?
Paul has made a comment about how he would take little bits of avant-garde ideas or concepts and incorporate it into the Beatles' music, whereas Lennon was more inclined to make the avant-garde concept the whole thing, like the Two Virgins or Life with the Lions, their second avant-garde album. So Tomorrow Never Knows
That's
is the one that
yeah.
comes to my mind. It's a really quite a simple song in that there's not a whole lot of contrast. I mean, you get the verse and it comes back, I think, seven times or something mm-hmm. like that. And even there, there's only one chord, C major, and then occasionally you get that organ B flat chord that juxtaposes against that C major chord. So, on one hand, it's extremely simple. But at the same time, they incorporate all this layering of these sound effects and tape loops, like the seagull's sound effect. That's depending on whose book you trust, it's either Paul laughing or tuning his guitar, and then it's been sped up and to the point where it sounds like seagulls. So you have a pop song that's kind of glazed with this avant-garde touches in these tape loops and weird sound effects, and then the solo from Taxman is supposedly cut up and played backwards or whatever the case is, and
right.
it's still accessible, but it's got these like little touches of more experimental and different types of sounds.
Yeah, I think that's much more interesting than, let's say, when we get to George doing an entire album of such things. But we'll get there in a minute here. Before we leave the group themselves. So, 67, we've got Sergeant Pepper, the pinnacle of a lot of people would argue the, you know, everything happening here, everything clicking. And A Day in the Life is probably one of the most famous examples of, okay, we've got space here. What are we going to do? And so you come up with this huge cluster that is scored. And can you talk about that particular song and some of its avant-garde touches, and then also the role of George Martin in reference to that?
A Day in the Life is often regarded as the Beatles' greatest single song. And I think Rolling Stone magazine published, you know, within the last couple years, you know, the 500 greatest songs or something like that. And I think Day in the Life was number one. And that's often the case when you list the top Beatles songs. Day in the Life is more often than not listed as number one. Part of the reason why is because it's a true collaboration.
Right.
So Lennon and McCartney are genuinely cooperating in the production of the song. So Lennon's got the "I read the news today, oh boy," and then Paul has the middle, you know, "woke up, fell out of bed." And while their songwriting collaboration was very common in their early years, the more they grew up and matured, the more they kind of drifted apart and developed their own styles. And for a while, you really don't get a lot of collaboration, you know, on most of the songs on Pepper. They're clear, you know, they're separate. You know, Paul wrote "Getting Better," you know, John wrote "Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite." They're pretty easily separated. Mm-hmm. Well, A Day in the Life, even though the sections are clearly separated as the, you know, John's section and Paul's section, the fact that they're putting them together does indeed represent a true collaboration for the first time for a while for the two of them. So on that's one reason why. Another reason why A Day in the Life is so highly regarded is because of its stylistic synthesis. So on one hand, it's a pop song, but at the same time, they supplement it with classical instrumentation in a full symphony orchestra. But then they don't use it in a classical style. They use that orchestra in an avant-garde style. Mm. And so rather than playing, you know, Mozart or something, they play something that's more along the lines of Ioannis Xenakis, the Greek avant-garde composer. And in the book, I talk a little bit about his piece Metastasis, which is very similar in that you have this massive string orchestra sound that grows and grows and grows and grows until it's just you know, huge. So, and then that also ties in with George Martin. You were talking about George Martin's
right.
help, influence. And what George Martin was able to do is be a kind of bridge between, on one hand, the pop musicians, which and the younger generation in general, and the classical musicians and the older generation that classical music really represents. So George Martin was able to kind of function as a go-between those two, and he was able to fuse together those two genres in a way that few others have been able to do. So that's really what George Martin does. You know, he takes the raw intuitive ideas of John Lennon and Paul McCartney, and he polishes it and turns it into a commercially viable and hugely successful product.
Mm-hmm. And especially on that song, a lot of our listeners will probably know how that all worked, but what were the orchestral players doing, and what would the score look like for the big climaxes before the middle section and at the end of the song?
Again, depending on whose book you trust, I've heard that Paul wanted them to just play randomly, and George Martin said, "Well, we have to give some organization to the chaos. We can't just have them play completely randomly, or it's not going to work at all." So that's what I mean about George Martin taking the raw intuitive ideas and polishing them, honing them and harnessing the idea and turning it into a product. So what appears to have happened is that George Martin said, start on a low note for each instrument and slowly get higher as you go. And eventually they end up on this big E major chord that both starts the bridge, Paul's section, and then the final piano chord at the very end. So classical musicians are used to paying close attention to those who are around them in the orchestra and listening to make sure that their product is cohesive with their neighbors and their other fellow musicians. And when George Martin asks them to deliberately not do that, it runs completely counter to everything that they had been trained to do. So he says, don't worry about listening to the guy next to you. You just go up at your own pace, and eventually we'll hit the high note at the very end. We'll all land together, but how we get there is more or less individual.
You have obviously musical background as well as I do, and have been around all classical musicians, and they don't like that stuff very much.
Not always. Yeah. Some of them are really into it, but most of them aren't.
Yeah, at least not. Even a lot of my students are kind of hesitate a little bit when you say, "Okay, just improvise whatever Let's just not read something on the music here." And it's just I don't know. There's a little bit of hesitation. But I think some of the interviews, they interviewed some of the orchestral musicians, and some either really loved it or others didn't get it at all. So,
yes.
But somebody who definitely would have gotten it would be Yoko. And
yes,
one thing I liked in your book is that you actually treat Yoko's art seriously. And, we tend to just dismiss her as the one who broke up the Beatles and all the myths and everything. But you have a long section about her background as an artist and conceptual artist, and also as a classical musician too. She was a pianist. What do you think, if you had to pick something for someone who doesn't know anything about her art, what would you say is maybe one of her most interesting artworks or writings, or things like Cut Piece or stuff like that? What could give you a good sense about what Yoko's about? And then what do you think were her biggest contributions to John?
Yoko is literally and figuratively at the center of the book. It's three chapters: one on Paul, one on Yoko, one on John. And so she's the second chapter, right in the center of the book, and she's the one that really sets in motion the dynamics that I mentioned earlier about how Paul started out as the avant-garde Beatle, and it ended as John. And the person responsible, or at least mostly largely responsible for that shift, is Yoko. And she had a lot of avant-garde experience prior to ever meeting John Lennon. And if I had to pick one piece that I think really captures what she's all about, it would have to be the White Chess Set.
Oh, yes.
And
that's great.
Yeah, well, it's so simple and kind of obvious, but at the same time, there's a lot of meaning behind it. And so the idea is you have two people playing chess, only using white characters and only with white squares on the board. There's no black anything. And chess, of course, is a game of war. It's strategic war rather than than physical or violent war, but it's still war. You're fighting your opponent. And of course, the more you play, the more the pawns, and all your figurines move around the board, the more confused the two sides get about which are the good guys and which are the bad guys, which is the whole point of the piece. Mm-hmm. And so eventually you realize that it's kind of hopeless playing an all-white chess set because you can't keep it straight. It's a good way of illustrating the problems of black and white thinking while simultaneously incorporating her kind of pacifist philosophy. You know, she did a lot with Lenin in later years. With the Bedins for Peace and whatnot.
Acorns and the planting the acorns.
Acorns for Peace, yes. So this is an early case of that. You know, she did this before she ever met John, but it shows how similar their thinking was, their pacifist thinking was, even before they met each other. And then, of course, when they did meet each other, it took off in an entirely new direction because they could combine forces and you'll work together.
Mm-hmm. Going back to those first three avant-garde recordings between John and Yoko, you have Two Virgins,
yes.
Life with the Lions, and then
yep.
The Wedding Album.
Yes.
Okay, I've listened to them all once or twice, maybe. Mm-hmm. Would you recommend anything, I hate to say redeeming, that's very subjective and judgmental, but apart from them being experimental and kind of curious, is there anything that you think is that portends what John would come up with later, or maybe some of Yoko's work, anything in those recordings that you particularly like or find interesting?
Yes. it's a tricky answer because it's one of it take something like Life with the Lions. It's a really interesting album when you think about the context in which it was produced. Mm. So the ideas behind the music are and the life that is behind the music, I find more compelling than the actual music itself. Mm-hmm. And that's what I really try to capture in the book is take this strange and unusual music, difficult music to listen to and appreciate, and explain why John and Yoko thought that this was worth capturing and putting onto an album and releasing commercially.
For people who don't know those albums, particularly the Life of the Lions, was at the time a lot of it was filmed or conceived while Yoko was in the hospital and was eventually miscarried their child, and so you have a track where John recorded the baby's heartbeat. You have fiddling around with a radio. You have a track called 2 Minutes Silence, which is what it is. And so just really almost more Yoko-like things, like if you want to think about her association with John Cage and 4 minutes, 33 seconds, and the idea of silence and just incoherence in a way. That's, again, almost more interesting in the concept than actually what you hear.
And it doesn't mean it's bad music. I don't mean to pass judgment on it, but it's to say you need to understand where the music is coming from,
right?
In order to at least appreciate, if not actually enjoy, what they were able to produce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So I'm thinking we've talked about Paul, we've talked about mm-hmm. John, talked about
yes.
Yoko, we mentioned George Martin, all of whom are featured front and center in your book.
Yes.
There's two left that we haven't really talked about here. And mm-hmm. You could take them in any order here, but what about George and Ringo? And what I know, George, recently they re-released the Apple albums, and his electronic sound is included in that set. So a lot of people may not know what that's about, but what about George and Ringo and their relationship to the avant-garde?
George was involved in Revolution 9, the making of Revolution 9, and you can hear his voice throughout the track.
Who's to know?
Yes, yeah. And the Watusi or El Dorado. Yeah, right. So he was definitely aware of this type of music, and the fact that he decided to record his own avant-garde album is very telling that he had some degree of interest in it. Now he has since gone on to disown completely the album Electronic Sound. I titled the section on George Avant-Garde Clou, because that's what he referred to this music as, Avant-Garde Clou music, you know, and said, I can't do the Liverpool accent, but it sounds like Haven't Got a Clou music if you can do the Liverpool accent. So it's very interesting that he was willing to experiment and he was willing to try, but at the same time, after he did try, he realized that, you know what, this really isn't my thing after all. But he had just gotten a Moog synthesizer, which was, you know, cutting edge back in the 60s. And so he wanted to try it out and just see what it could do. And so he created his own avant-garde album of all this experimental sounds using this synthesizer. But at the same time, you know, he was never terribly proud of it. Many scholars and authors have denounced it quite viciously. I have to say, listening to it, I don't think it's a bad album. There are redeeming things about it. I think there's a strong sense of structure to it, and that I really appreciate when listening to it. That being said, I think Paul and John's some of their stuff is a little bit more interesting and successful than George was, and I think George would agree with that. And then Ringo, there, when I was researching for the book, I was able to find a couple of different things that referenced Ringo wanting to create his own experimental drum album. I was never able to find, one of my big problems with Beatles scholarship is that so few sources are cited, and that's why mine is incredibly meticulous, and every single quote and everything is cited, is because I can't stand it when I'm reading someone else's book, and I think, this is great, I wonder where they got this from, and I have no idea, because they don't cite the sources. So, you know, I was able to find that in a couple different books, but none of them were able to direct me to a, you know, like an interview or anything that I could follow up on. There was also a few comments in Mark Lewisohn's book, The Complete Beatles Recording Sessions, that have similar, you know, things. A 10-minute experimental drum solo by Ringo took place on, you know, whatever day it was. But apparently none of those recordings have survived, or if they have, they certainly haven't been published, much like Carnival of Light. So it's hard to find any conclusive evidence or research to link Ringo with any of these ideas. Now, certainly he was open to trying all these things. So when Paul and John come in and say, hey, why don't we do Carnival of Light or whatever, Ringo's happy to play along and do what he can. But at the same time, he never really sought out this more experimental side the way the other three, even including George Harrison, did.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what you have to say about the George album is particularly interesting, and I don't want to give it away here, but if you thought My Sweet Lord was a little bit of a problem with some plagiarism, it actually happened a little bit earlier, maybe. So I don't want to give it away, but I found that particularly interesting too. But yeah, very much it was the John, Paul, Yoko group here putting things forward. Even though, as you say, and just a couple questions left here, on Revolution 9, which is... Mm-hmm. Certainly, I think in every book or every survey, it's almost always ranked number one worst Beatles song and most hated, or maybe up with Mr. Moonlight.
You Like Me Too Much as my number one. I can't stand that song.
Yeah, that's pretty much phoning it in for George on that one.
Sorry, George.
Sorry, George. But yeah, George did have a hand, as you say, in Revolution 9, and in classes in universities on electronic music, people do actually teach Revolution 9 and treat it as a serious artwork, even if there were, you know, some of the stuff that happened was just happenstance. Things just kind of worked. But right. what would you say is Revolution 9's impact? And for somebody who doesn't like it, what could you mm-hmm. suggest for maybe giving it a second listen?
Actually, this is something that I just realized relatively recently, which is why I wasn't able to include it in my book. It's only after finishing the book that I went back and started looking at the structure of Revolution 9 and realized that it's not as abstract as I originally thought it was. There is actually a story being told through this collage of sound effects. And there's, roughly speaking, a three-part structure to Revolution 9. The first part is the longest. I think it's the first 4 minutes or so that, in general, builds in intensity. You go from a rather calm, it starts with that opening, B minor piano playing that's really quite calm and serene. And little by little, it builds. And then you get to the second section, roughly 4 or 5 minutes in, that is much more intense and a lot more things going on. There's things like gunshots, cannon sound effects and laser guns. And there's all this kind of violent aural imagery to it. So you have this build up to this revolution, then the middle section, the second part, is the revolution itself. And then afterwards, you get this kind of return to normalcy where the sereneness of the opening is essentially reprised. And what's most fascinating about that is that Yoko Ono only appears in that third section.
Oh.
So it's almost as in, it's almost autobiographical for Lennon, and I don't know if he intended this or not, but he goes through all the craziness in the mid '60s of Beatlemania and all this the crazy life that was the Beatles at that time, and so he kind of goes through all this chaotic mess, and his pot of gold at the end of the rainbow is Yoko. And she is not heard until 6 minutes and 53 seconds into the track, and then for the next minute she's heard pretty much constantly saying a variety of things
including
if you become naked and other things. Yes. So it's really interesting to me how he sets that up, how he saves Yoko's voice for the end, when things kind of calm down again and return to normal. And in fact, that's what revolution means. If you think about the Earth revolving around the sun, one revolution is one complete passage around the sun. So you end up back where you started, but you're not, you're not the same person you were before the revolution happened, and so Yoko really represents that completion for Lennon, kind of a starting over, and that's what Two Virgins was all about. It's two people who are kind of reborn when they find each other, and you can see that looking at Revolution 9.
That's very interesting. I think you have another article there. You've definitely got something with that interpretation, because I've never thought of it that way. I'm just looking purely at the technical aspect, but to step back and extract that really does give you a sense that maybe there was method to the madness behind that.
Oh, there's a lot of structure to it, and that's what you don't get in Two Virgins, because it's so off the cuff or improvised. But with Revolution 9, you get the same kind of thing, but it's much more structured, and it really does tell a story.
Yeah. And you could even maybe extract it even further about what always strikes me about Revolution 9 is its placement on the album. It just is so striking how it fades out into Good Night all of a sudden. It just is really, kind of, what is going on here? And
they do a double take.
Yeah. They were so brilliant to put it in that spot for maximum effect. So
right.
So I've always been a fan of Revolution 9, and don't just skip it like a lot of people. But
right.
I think what you said will give people another chance to go through it and hear that happening. So
sure. Yeah. So
look, putting it all together here, how does knowing this and all the research that you've put in, how does it enhance our appreciation of these songs that we've heard so many times and love? What would you say for people to do, or how did it enhance your own appreciation of the Beatles' music with this particular facet?
It helps explain how and why the Beatles were able to produce the music and the art that they did, because it provides context and background, and you understand. A lot of what this book is all about is understanding what John Lennon saw in Yoko Ono and why he found that so attractive and so appealing, and why he felt the need to essentially start his life over. So he divorced Cynthia Lennon and moved in with Yoko, and from then on committed to her fully. So it's really about context and understanding the why behind the music. And I mentioned earlier, you can appreciate the Beatles' music quite profoundly without needing any sort of technical understanding or that sort of context. But when you do find that context, it does give you a new perspective on which you can appreciate the music that you've known and loved for a long time. And I think I'd like to close with, I'm just going to read the very end of the book. Mm-hmm. And so the conclusion is all about how the Beatles were aware of their artistic surroundings and how they were able to take little bits and pieces from all these different styles, including avant-garde music, and incorporate it into their product. So here's the last two paragraphs of the book. What everybody, not just artists or musicians, can learn from the Beatles' example is to adopt that same deliberate exposure to and awareness of artistic surroundings. Without constant stimulation and revaluation, aesthetic development stagnates. Only through deliberate exposure to aesthetically challenging material can perceptions of beauty develop. When that happens, the weirdness often disappears, replaced by understanding of and appreciation for the product. What is most fascinating, though, is that the music itself is not changing. It is the listener who changes. And yet, great art seems to change with us, reflecting our individual aesthetic development and progress, showing us where we have been and how far we have come by illuminating our ever-evolving perceptual faculties.
Well, that says it all, I think, and really will enhance how we listen to things. And you can experience the music for what it is and how great it is, but if there's this deeper level here that makes it even more, it's aesthetically challenging but also beautiful in its own way too. And the Beatles as experimentalists and always striving for something new and to enrich their music and push beyond really comes through. And I think it's pretty fascinating and gives a new angle that we haven't really seen. We've heard some of the stories, but to frame it this way, I think, is really very, very interesting. So
yeah, that's the goal of the book.
Yeah, oh, definitely. And so how can people get the book?
Yes. Yeah, that's a good thing to ask, isn't it?
Yes.
It is available on Amazon.com. It's also on Barnes & Noble. You can find it on my own website, which is just myname.com. So it's AaronKerowicz.com. And that's a mouthful. So it might actually be easier if you just go on Google and search Aaron Beatles. I think I'm the first thing to come up if you do that. So there's a variety of ways that you can get a hold of it, both paperback, hard copy, or on my website I sell a PDF copy as well. If you prefer a digital copy, you can get it that way.
And we'll put a link in our podcast description so you can follow that and go right to your website and read some more about it if you're interested. So
very good.
Great. Well, Aaron Kadovich, thank you so much for speaking with me today. And it's been a pleasure. And
absolutely.
You've given me a lot of things to go back and listen to again. And I think I want to go out today now that I'm inspired to listen to Revolution 9 again.
Yes.
I think we're going to have to go out with that, with a little bit of that. So thanks again for speaking with us. And Chris will be back with me for another Songs Under the Microscope episode, where we're going to look at a B-side. I won't tell you what it is, but you'll get to hear about a 1965 B-side. So look forward to that in the future. So thanks again, Aaron.
My pleasure.
And we'll catch you next time.
Number nine.
Time went by, they'd get a little bit older and a little bit slower.